It's the show Agent Orange / Adolf Twitler would love to shut down.
So here's the story, folks. I am the least black person that you've ever seen in your entire life. In fact, we did very well relative to racist people.
It's the no bullshit zone.
It's called fake news.
It's the Shaggy Jenkins Show.
I know who you are. Just wait.
On the Pacifica Radio Network.
It's the Shaggy Jenkins Show on the Pacifica Radio Network. Welcome back. Today, we blast off into some kind of spacey stories. We'll go with Trump's stellar attacks, Mueller's upcoming appearance that could either be supernova or a black hole. And then, of course, we will start off the show with my favorite part, shooting at the moon. Before we get there, a guy that is joining us, not from Houston, but pretty close to what was once known as Mercury Control. Then became Houston, but he is a, I guess I could say, kind of out there guy. Please welcome the very orbital Drew Landry, everyone.
Thank you for that. Such incredible, that so wonderful, out of this world introduction. Thank you so much, Shaggy.
Yeah, you know, I'm just going to say this because this is one of those things, Drew. today's show, because we are going to be talking about not only NASA, but Trump, Twitter, and Mueller, I thought we should start the show with as much humor as possible because... Here's the thing. All of those topics have very, very dark sides. And I know what you're thinking. How could the Apollo mission have dark sides? So today, I know this is the funny part. Everybody is like, oh, yeah, over the weekend, July 20th, that was 50th anniversary of the Apollo moon landing. That was Apollo 11, Michael Collins, Buzz Aldrin, Neil Armstrong. If you don't look it up, if you don't know anything about it, as they say, you better ask somebody. Because it happened. But today, we can actually say is congratulations for the 50th anniversary of the first moon landing was fake conspiracy theory.
Yeah, I'm not even going to talk about it. Go ahead.
As astronauts were passing Lagrange Point between Earth and the moon, heading back into their, you know, successful finish of their mission, yeah, somebody, you know, somewhere started saying, hey, it's not possible that we went to the moon. So today would be the 50th anniversary of the first time that somebody said, it's fake. It's fake. It's all fake.
It's everything is terrible. Yes. I mean, you know, you look at all the crazy other conspiracy theories that are out there, you know, that, you know, climate change is a conspiracy set up by the Chinese and all this other, you know, crazy stuff that people want to just say. I mean, you know, look, that's the beauty part of freedom of speech. But I think, you know, you owe a little bit more responsibility when you're a person of power or have some sort of an influence. And well, that's why you are such a good model for us on this Apollo 11 and the interest you have in the moon.
Yeah. Yeah. You would think that, when it comes to conspiracy theorists, they would kind of take a look at how outlandish their conspiracy has to be and the reality of it and go, yeah, no, I'm not going to go that route. But here's the thing, Drew, I want to ask you because this is one of the things that everybody takes differently. When man actually landed on another planet in our solar system for the first time, that kind of changed us as a species, did?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, you know, you just imagine the wonderful imagination that you had. You know, I just think back when, you know, with the recorded speech that Kennedy gave in the early 60s, talking about wanting to land somebody on the moon, of how all efforts were now put into this. And, you know, we could also remember, we could also think about it, that how, you know, with presidents that came after him could have simply said, we're not doing it anymore. You know, that was Kennedy's thing. We're, you know, we're done with that. But, you know, to the credit of Lyndon Johnson, to the credit of even Richard Nixon, they continued it on. So, you know, that is something that they saw from the beginning to the end. in that decade. I mean, what a goal. I mean, for to do something that you didn't have any idea what how much it was going to cost, how long it was going to really take, the type of math that I don't have any idea about to even do, or any, all the other type of analytics and the other stuff to deal with it. For a president to say that we're going to do that in 1961, by the end of the decade, I mean, it borders on the arrogance, but it also tries to propel the imagination and get people motivated to get to a goal and say, we're going to achieve this. I mean, that's pretty bold.
Yeah, well, let's talk a little bit about how they had to go into achieving this, because a lot of people think that the Apollo mission was it. By the time they got to the Apollo mission, it was like, hey, Apollo mission is only about the moon, and everything before it was kind of meh, and everything after it's kind of meh. But they don't realize that Apollo, the whole Apollo period, actually encompassed about six different NASA programs. And this is the thing that I got to bring up. The very first man that stepped foot on the moon. Drew, would you say that it's a little bit of a miracle that we still have Neil Armstrong around at 1969 to go to the moon with his previous career?
Yes, it is. All the things he endured. I mean, very complicated guy. Shooken. I think just about every astronaut and every politician who supported it was very shaken by the disaster that had Gus Grissom involved in it. I mean, these are just setbacks that could have happened and constantly could have had brought in a lot of doubt about whether we can even get there. So you're right. All the things that could have went wrong and said, we may not even have this Armstrong guy. It's a bit of a miracle about it. Yeah. And it's great.
Yeah. Because let's just go ahead and say that when it comes to, and I'm going to get like really kind of, how do I say this? I'm going to get really kind of out there with this, because when we talk about the early days of the moon missions and trying to leave the surface of planet Earth, things were a little bit more mythologically epic, I want to say, yeah. Drew.
Yeah.
So, I mean, let's just put it in this context. When you have a guy like a Neil Armstrong that is flying in the face of the will of the gods themselves, oh, lo, did they try to smite him a many time before he even made it into the Apollo program. Now, for a lot of people, they don't realize that he was a war bomber, got shot down. Mm-hmm. That's right. That happened. There was another time that he was in the Bell X series of experiments, and his plane once again almost killed him.
Yeah.
He walked away from that and basically said, "Nah, I need to ride back into town." Now, the third time, he was on this thing, and this is all on planet Earth. Let's not forget that twice space tried to kill Neil Armstrong. Just on Earth, though, the third time, he was trying to practice with the Lunar Landing Module Test Vehicle. And this thing had no wings. It looked like a spider with a big jet thing in it. To this day, science cannot explain how 1/100th of a second before the explosion, Neil Armstrong was able to safely catapult away from the fireball in the sky. Nobody, computers or otherwise, can figure out how that man's reflexes were so fast that 1/100th of a second before, boom, he cleared the craft safely.
Yeah.
Now, here's the thing about that. There was a massive explosion, a lot of property damage because of this big fireball. Neil Armstrong walked away in his flight suit, cut his parachute off, and I am not making this up, walked back to his office on base and started filling out the paperwork about the crash.
Yeah.
Now, when somebody came into his office and they were just like, stating the obvious, Mr. Armstrong, yeah, you were almost killed in a fiery wreck. He basically said, yeah, well, somebody's got to fill out the forms.
Yeah. that kind of, there's a special type of thing that you have in your head that, you just are dedicated to the mission at hand, and things around you, they can set you back, but your response to those things defines who you are, defines how dedicated you are to that goal. And look, you know, for someone to say, hey, you almost died, I could imagine, you know, him possibly saying, yeah, I was there, but I'm here. So yeah. What more do you, you know, what more do you want me to do? I mean, you know, there's only so much that I can, you know, I can't cry about it. I mean, what's that going to do about the you know, whole situation here? I got to fill this out. I got to go on. We got to keep moving on. I mean, that's a special type of person. I mean, it really is.
Oh yeah. Well, let's not forget either, dude, that this is only the Earthbound times that the yeah. world tried to kill him. Let's not forget his stint in both the Mercury and Gemini programs prior to the Apollo programs. My favorite one, though, is because I don't want to run out of time too much today, but let's talk about the Mercury program where him and an errant Aegean missile had an encounter in orbit. Drew, how much do you know about Neil Armstrong and space itself trying to throw him off like a flea?
You know, I missed that assignment, so you're going to have to help me out here.
Okay, once again, in an example of why Neil Armstrong was not human. Okay, at this point of his life, he has walked away from bomber wreckages, from test aircraft wreckages. He's walked away from fireballs, from mid-air collisions, he's literally done this to every disaster in life. Just dusted the shoulders off a little bit, like, on to the next one. Mm-hmm. But then space decided to throw him a literal curveball. So during the early stages of the Apollo missions, which were, at this point, still called Gemini, which is Gemini for anybody else, but... I love listening to the old tapes. The Gemini 7 craft is going into space.
Gemini.
By Gemini. We'll go to orbit yet.
Gemini Cricket, yeah.
Great. So, during the Gemini program, Neil Armstrong kind of surprised everybody, both on the ground and in the capsule, when, after docking to an Aegean missile, this is not actually an explosive missile. This was a test case that they made to test how the Apollo and command modules would link up on their way to the moon. During this exercise, he noticed a little bit of a list. You know, the thing was kind of, every so often we're turning and this isn't good. So he sent an emergency command. Boom, shut down the Aegean. The Aegean said that it registered the command, but he's looking out the window going, we're still drifting. Anybody notice that, right? Right? So, Neil Armstrong, in his infinite wisdom, said, maybe, we need to cut loose from the Aegean craft before it goes crazy.
Mm-hmm.
Well, he does. And that's when the Gemini craft, I love saying it, itself goes crazy. You see, the problem wasn't with the Aegean. The problem was with the craft he actually was in, with a nozzle thruster being stuck open. So as soon as the extra mass of the Aegean was lost, the Gemini started spinning around, generating a force of around 3.5 Gs. Now, computer-based control on the ground at, that was later called Houston, but at that time was called Mercury Control, couldn't get a handle on what things to do. Neil Armstrong, in crushing gravity, kind of calmly reached over and says, I'll just use the emergency thruster controls right here. Pulls the emergency thruster controls, aborts the orbit, deorbits the craft, and lands manually, no computer assistance.
Jeez.
So with a broken spacecraft that was spinning around at a gravitational force enough to crush bones, he was able to reach forward and activate manual controls, stabilizing the craft, deorbiting it, and landing safely. So if you ever want to know exactly how much crap Neil Armstrong went, because everybody's like, does Neil Armstrong, in the hindsight of history, really deserve to be the first man on the moon? You're thinking, yeah.
Yeah.
Everything tried to kill this man, and he was still like, nope, we're going to the moon.
Yeah. This is all fascinating to me because I just, you know, it's really neat. And this is a part of American history that I don't really get to spend a lot of time on. But I do want to make mention that, you know, there is a political aspect to this, because we have to, you know, one thing that we forgot to mention was that, you know, we're in this space race with the Soviet Union, who actually got a person in space before we did. And of course, what we did was that we freaked out. And, you know, and all the things that you mentioned there, we never really tried. And it was always about trial on error, always about trying to figure out how we can get from point A to point B. And we had all of these different missions going in here. And so all the people from John Glenn down to, Armstrong and Collins and those who went after and went to the moon after that. I mean, these are all particular things that you know, is just a great achievement that we've made. And, you know, and regardless of being Republicans and Democrats and all that political stuff, this was a goal that we set out. This is perseverance is what it is. And I mean, they could have easily just, you know, after a first, you know, a couple of bad experiments, just pulled the plug and say, forget it, but we didn't want to do it. And I think that, you know, speaks, and look, can be a little patriotic here, but it speaks to the American spirit. It speaks to the stick-with-itness that we ever so miss today.
Ah, yes, because let's not forget the last time that space itself tried to kill Neil Armstrong was with him and Buzz Aldrin on the actual moon.
Yeah.
There was a special landing computer developed at that time by NASA that was supposed to calculate the angles and all of the speeds and stuff that they would need to deorbit safely from a lunar trajectory orbit. Problem. The calculations happened so fast, and part of the computer was actually Earth-based, and the communications took so long to go back and forth that the computer overloaded, basically sending the Apollo 11 Eagle capsule into the side of a mountain. Now, of course, Armstrong knew that this was happening, saw it was, grabbed the controls, and flew the craft manual. And then ground control, no joke, had to remind him, Neil, there's not a gas station on the moon. You need to come down quick. You're about to run out of fuel.
Oh.
With 10 seconds of fuel to spare, Neil Armstrong manually landed the craft on the moon, and that's what happened July 20th of 1969.
That's amazing.
Now, this is the other amazing thing, because a lot of people don't know about what I like to call the loneliest man in existence.
Yeah.
And the reason why is because the classic photograph showing the surface of the moon and the Earth rising above it in the distance was taken on a Hasselblad camera. I think I'm saying that right. Hasselblad? Yeah. It was taken on one of those. And it was taken by astronaut Michael Collins, the one guy that on the Apollo 11 mission didn't get to go down to the surface of the moon. He was in the command module. Now, as he is rotating around the other side of the moon, he takes this picture that clearly, if you could have this type of focus in that camera, would show the two men on the surface of the moon, some 3 billion people that were alive at that time on planet Earth. It would be a picture of everything that humanity has ever known to have existed, except for one guy, Michael Collins.
Mm-hmm.
Now, go for it.
Hey, you're doing a great job. I was just going to say that picture is just iconic and something that we'll always keep in mind forever. I mean, that's just an amazing, amazing picture, and the presence of mind that he had to take it.
Yeah, because let's not forget, while his buddy Neil was on the surface, making what people called cosmic history. What is cosmic anyway? They ask Michael Collins, it's like, so while he was taking his first step on the moon and you were just kind of,
well, got the place to myself, might as well walk around in my underwear.
You know, I will float around, you know.
Yeah.
Zero. Anyway. While he was doing that, people were like, well, you know, Neil Armstrong was saying the words, you know, that's one small step for, and this is the thing, the radio crackled, and this was missed on planet Earth. One small step for a man, one giant leap for mankind.
Yeah.
So there was a little distinct difference in what we heard and what Neil Armstrong actually said, and transcripts came out years later and let us know. But Michael Collins, meanwhile, going around the moon, says, hey, I'm going to take this picture of everybody. Click. And then it hit Tim. I am now the furthest man ever from planet Earth in a spacecraft designed and built by the lowest bidder.
Yeah.
And that is, if you really think about it, that was the beauty of the Apollo moon mission, is even the guy that was there furthest away from humanity ever before realized, yeah, we got here on the cheap.
Yeah.
There were so many things we could have upgraded. This is so bad a design.
There's this one thing that I just, this is comical and silly, but I want to mention it. I don't know if you ever watched the Ali G show, when he had Buzz Aldrin on there, and he was going to ask him about, you know, the conspiracy theorists about, you know, how they said he faked the moon landing and all that stuff. So he's, you know, Aldrin is feeling like that he's about to be asked this question, and he's gearing up for it because he's heard this build up to this question several times ago. You know, Ali G tells him, so tell us what it was like to tell people that the moon doesn't exist. Well, he was caught off guard because he wasn't prepared to answer that question.
Nobody is.
I don't think people say that the moon doesn't exist. Then he later calls him Buzz Lightyear, but it's just even. But anyway, I remember that part. That's one of the, you know, more hilarious things that you can find people just out of their box and unprepared for.
Yeah. But here's the thing, because I kind of want to bring this up, because if you're talking about comical moment, please do yourself a favor. On the 50th anniversary of the Apollo astronaut landing on the moon, the real moon, not the fake one, look at the flight transcripts. Yeah. Oh, my God. Apparently, there was this problem with floating feces on their way to the moon. See, the toilet. Remember how I said the whole thing was designed on the cheap? Well, the toilet was too, and every so often it would just let something free in the cabin, and the astronauts would have to chase it down.
Oh.
And they used to try to guess whose poo it was by the shape and size of said poo floating through the Apollo 11 craft. This is on national record. It's one of the greatest things you will ever learn about the Apollo program. They had to have poo patrol.
I really hope this all sounds all too familiar, like a scene from Caddyshack. I really hope no one on there thought it was a baby Ruth.
No.
Good.
No, but apparently Buzz Aldrin can eat the most amount of oatmeal on the way to the moon. He's had 19 bags before they even reached the moon.
Oh, my.
Yes. Neil Armstrong had a particular terrible taste in music that he kept playing over and over again, much to the chagrin of Collins and Aldrin. At one point, them saying that they were going to eject him from the craft if he played it again with his turds.
Literally, get your S-H-I-N, get out. There.
So, but that's one of the things, is because, yeah, this was like a wild, almost like, what is that thing called? Oh, the Hangover. This is like the Hangover in space. Is, if you read the transcript, that's what it really amounts to, the Apollo missions, but.
That's cool.
One of the most fascinating things, though, is something that came out of this program. And I'm going to, this is how we're going to close out this segment, because, Drew, NASA kind of figured out something was up with Neil, Buzz, and Michael when they landed on the ground. Something was different. Do you know what that different thing was?
They're the first people to leave and come back. I don't know. Tell me.
They started acting differently.
Oh.
Radically differently, by the way.
Mm.
And it all had to do with something called, and this is the thing. Remember how I said the Apollo missions weren't just the Apollo missions, that we actually learned so much from them that it went further and further and further? Well, in the mid-1970s, when the Soviet Union stopped going high, like the moon, and started making space stations, America said, why go to the moon when we should be really with this whole space station race? And that's where Skylab and things like that came, the Soyuz program, the Mir program, and eventually the collaboration of the ISS. But NASA started upping the amount of people they would put into orbit. And that meant that a lot of people were now starting to hang around NASA after coming back from space, acting what I would like to call spacey. And it was something that was eventually called the overview phenomenon. And this is the quote that Michael Collins came up with. And I want you, oh my God, we're going to run out of time. But this is the quote that he came to. Quote, I really believe that if the political leaders of the world could see their planet from a distance of, say, 100,000 miles, their outlook would be fundamentally changed. The all-important borders would be invisible, the noisy arguments suddenly silenced. The tiny globe would continue to turn, serenely ignoring its subdivisions, presenting a unified facade that would cry out for a unified understanding, for homogeneous treatment, homogeneous as it were. The Earth must become as it appeared, blue and white, not capitalist or communist, not rich or poor, not envious or envied.
That's beautiful.
It is. And that's where we've got to end this segment. When we come back, we'll talk about the things on planet Earth that are a part of those subdivisions and ugliness and actually kind of resemble the floating poo of the Apollo program. When we get back, it's the Shaggy Chicken Show.
Too much consumption of the Shaggy Jenkins Show could result in a higher IQ, a better understanding of the world, and not being called a f***ing idiot as much. It's the Shaggy Jenkins Show.
It's the Shaggy Jenkins Show. We're back from outer space. If you missed any part of our stellar first part of the show, I encourage you to go to ShaggyJenkins.com or look for us on Spotify, iHeartMedia, iTunes, you know, wherever. Joining me from a place somewhere halfway between the United States two coast and what we like to call gun country. Please welcome the ever affable and loquacious? Yeah, loquacious Drew Landry. I am trying bigger words and failing.
Hey, we're all trying today. We all got our try hard helmets on, so it's good.
Well, you would think so, because over the weekend, Drew, I noticed that as much as we've talked about, and we didn't even mention this, there was kind of like a little mini reunion of the surviving Apollo astronaut that happened over the weekend, a little heartwarming moment. But one of the things that came out of this weekend was Donald Trump on Sunday renewed his attack against four freshman House Democrats. All women, all minority. And I got to say that before we even get into the context of all the stuff that he was talking about, the rally in North Carolina, the fallout from that, before we get into any of that, Drew, why is he still at it?
Well, you know, there's a variety of things about this. There's the political ramifications over this. There's, you know, just all of that there. It's just really just to score as many points as he can for his presidential run. I mean, he's, you know, really trying to put these four women at front of the Democratic Party and saying this is the face of the Democratic Party and these are just no good, awful people and they're anti-Semitic and they hate this country, and how can you ever be, you know, this is what the party is. The Democratic Party hates America and is anti-Semitic, hates Israel. All this type of rhetoric coming out of Trump's mouth saying I'm less hateful than all of them because of things that of criticism that they have laid down upon him and of other aspects that the country is liable to have because we are not perfect, despite what the president wants and his supporters want us to think. This is where we are. I mean, so he says they need to go back to where they came from and try to fix their socialist agendas and whatever else. I mean, this is all this craziness is all at the fault of the president here.
I just want to ask on behalf of one of these people, exactly how much socialism exists in Lower Brooklyn?
Yeah, good question.
I mean, you know, you got AOC, you got Bernie Sanders. Maybe some does exist there. I don't know.
Yeah.
And the reason I bring that up is because Mitch McConnell over the weekend basically said, you know what? Yeah. I think the president's really onto something to attacking these four women. Can I just have a moment where I'm saying, at what point in American history do older white men gang up on women of color who are much younger than them? And the country looks at this and says, we'll have it. Go for it.
Yeah, that
I'll allow it, as they say.
Yeah. it's so incredibly just bad. I mean, you know, McConnell's just guilty by association here. You know, he's wanting to say, you know, look, you know, yeah, he's on to something because of, you know, he thinks that this has to do with the Democratic Party's socialism, which doesn't exist. But they're just obsessed by saying because they want the government to do X, Y, and Z, that somehow equals socialism. And, you know, with the agendas for, you know, saying that health care is a human right, that somehow is socialism. And, this is the Republican talking points here. You know, if you think that health care is a right and should be provided for all people, that somehow equals socialism. And that somehow is a negative aspect because that failed in other countries. Yet they often like to just completely ignore Northern European countries and the Scandinavian countries and, you know, other Western European countries where this is provided and how it actually works there. But don't just, you know, don't ever pay attention to that. Always look at the other countries that don't do well, and we'll say they're socialist, and therefore it's bad.
Well, this is the thing. Socialism, non-socialism, capitalism, fascism, whatever.
Istanisms, whatever.
Yeah. As Peter Brog said, no isms, ponderitums. But the thing is, Drew, I got to bring this up to light here, because with all of this rhetoric going around, McConnell basically says, hey, it's okay to gang up on younger women. This should be something that's allowed because they're socialist, which they're clearly not. But because they're socialist and we're so prosperous, we're clearly not, that it's okay for this type of behavior to exist. Now, I gotta ask, because Donald Trump once again picked up the racist stigma over the weekend, and is still, this is something that we haven't even mentioned yet, that send them back chant, send her back at the North Carolina rally, that may have seemed like a distant memory to some, but Drew, apparently in D.C., that is kind of the prevailing argument of the day of whether Trump incited that chant, rehearsed that chant, or was it really as random as he says, and that has meaning, doesn't it?
It has a whole lot of meaning. I mean, this is, look, I mean, he says he disavows it. I mean, he tweets, you know, he says this sort of thing, yet, you know, he openly stated that if you don't want to be here, you can leave. You know, if you don't love this country, you know, it's back to this 1960, 1950, 1970 mentality, you love it or leave it. And it's like, you know, if somehow you want to criticize the country or the leadership, somehow you don't love the country. I think that's the whole aspect of criticism, is that you care a lot for it. You want it to improve. Therefore, you have ideas as to how to do that. But that's a whole other conversation. What we're talking about here, dealing with the context of the president's tweet and, you know, stating how, you know, a Congresswoman Omar, who migrated from the failed state of Somalia with her family and now lives in Minnesota, is an elected official. These are all American citizens. Let's just understand this. These four women are all American citizens, and he's telling them to go back to their countries where apparently socialism failed. This is so incredibly crazy. I mean, yes, Omar was not born here, but she's a naturalized citizen. And so, you know, these are four American citizens who are elected officials. So we kind of have to understand that, you know, that this is not a send them back. This is an incredibly sexist and incredibly racist, inciting here that he's just bringing out. And the fact that he didn't have his John McCain moment, that if you remember back in the 2008 campaign, that he just shut down this particular woman who said that, you know, Barack Obama is an Arab and scared and whatever. I mean, he just took the microphone away and said, no, he's not. No, he's not. And well, Trump could have said, no, don't send him back. But no, he waits till the whole thing's over, revels in the whole, chanting of send her back as, you know, in his Mussolini-esque, Il Duce look on his face. And yes, exactly just like that.
Yeah.
And then sends out a tweet and sends out a message. Well, I disavow those things. He does this crap all the time. He does this crap. Well, I loved it then. I don't love it anymore. And then he attacks the press, which is a whole other issue, because it's, you know, this is all echoing of 1984 is really what this comes down to. Anything that he can do to just discredit anyone who reports anything about him. Now I've kind of gone into different directions here, but let me come back to the main aspect this is all about the aspect of the whole race baiting that he loves to do. And his main goal again is to win in 2020. And he thinks he can do this by putting these four women out as being the face of the opposition party. And saying that, well, you're being forced to defend them now. Well, here you go.
Here's the thing. He might have been a little successful. How do I say this? People that generally just consume conservative viewpoints and conservative news have, in recent polls, overwhelmingly been shown to think that AOC and the rest of the squad, including Presley and Omar, that is the face of the Democratic Party. When, yeah, in fact, they're four freshmen, low seniority representatives that don't really have a lot of power at this moment because they're still in their freshman year, the true face would be Pelosi and Schumer. Why is it that they've shifted, or Trump specifically, has shifted from Pelosi and Schumer and wanting people in his base to take these four young women as the face of the Democrats? What's to gain in that?
You know, he can't take it out on Pelosi because, you know, Pelosi just takes his lunch and eats it right in front of him and says, you got nothing on me. You know, she really stands up to him and she's a well-respected leader in all this. He picks on them because it's easier to really rev up the base and to put them at front of the party and make them look like that they're the face of it so that they can seem like they're the enemy. You know, that's why you often hear of those in the conservative media saying AOC and saying, you know, Omar, and trying to make it seem like that Democrats are anti-Semitic and that they hate America and they're so pro socialism that somehow these four women are the face of all that. And that's his plan. That's what it comes down to, is that if I can put these four women who are freshman congresswomen, who, just like you said, whenever there's a committee hearing, they're sitting towards the front. All the senior, all the powerful members of any type of committee are sitting at the very back. They're sitting close to the chairman or even the chair of any type of committee here. So, you know, but these four ladies are at the very front. They're at the very bottom. And so they don't have a lot of power, except the fact that they're like the boogeyman, if you will. You know, the ooh, AOC, make my base scared so that they don't vote for, you know, somebody who is young or vibrant or older or anyone running for the Democratic side for president so that I can maintain my presence in the White House.
So wait a minute.
If that makes any sense.
No, because about like 2 minutes ago, you said something that hit me and I've just been kind of here seeing stars, but I now regaining consciousness. You said something that's pretty hard hitting that I don't think anybody realizes the precedence of. So I just want to back this up here.
Sure.
Apparently, according to the logic of the day, it is much more easier to go after somebody like an Ocasio-Cortez, like a Presley, like an Omar. It's easier to go after them because they are younger women of no power. However, mm-hmm. going up against an older woman of power, of stature, that is something that Trump does not and his base doesn't possess the mental capacity to do.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, that makes some sense. Sure.
Okay. Because that seems like it's what you were saying is like, look, if you're one of those people that follows the main Trump narrative, you are too dumb to get the fact that the real fight is with Schumer and Pelosi. They're the ones that actually hold the power towards the back of the room. But if you're kind of a shallow, kind of an arrogant person that doesn't really know about how government works, you're going to see the people all front and think, well, that's the power structure. So in a way, you're basically saying that Trump's support relies on his base being the dumbest one.
Yeah, I didn't really want to come off that way, but that's, you know, he's selling it that way. You know, he's selling it. Hey, look, don't trust the media. Don't trust what they're telling you. They're all fake news. Don't trust the polls. They're all fake polls. I'll tell you what I want because I will tweet it out, and that's my message. And those four powerless women are the ones who you can blame the entire Democratic Party on, and they're going to defend them, and all the media is going to defend them. But, you know, so, he's channeling all of those things, all of his problems, all of those particular things that he has problems with onto these four women. Whereas it used to be the Pelosi-Rand party. I mean, he can't do that anymore because she's just basically taking him out to the woodshed every time they get into any type of squabble, and she's able to come out on top on that because she has power and she's able to wield it. Whereas these four don't have power. And therefore, the only thing that they have is the same outlet that he does, but his base is larger, and it comes down to making them out to be the face of the party. So yes, he wants them to believe what he has to say, wants his base to believe what he has to say, not the reports that are coming out.
But as long as we're having a show where we talk about astronomical leaps here, you're saying basically in a nutshell, and this is the thing. Really starting to hit me how wrong and scary this is.
Yeah.
That it is so much more easier for white middle class men in America to support beating down and denigrating women of color than it is for them to accept confronting an older Caucasian lady of power.
Yeah, that's exactly what it comes down to. If you look at some polls that even the Democrats just leaked out just a few days ago, AOC, Congresswoman Cortez, Congresswoman Tlaib, Congresswoman Presley, and Congresswoman Omar poll very, very low among all the types of people that the president attracts. And these are white men without college degrees. There's a reason that the president is focusing on them. There's a reason for that. And it's the fact that he's going to rely on them to come out to vote and next November and support them. And if he can position the Democrats to defend them and if he can place them as the face of the party, that's going to make the lower class type of people that the president always aims for to feel like that the party that they once supported is no longer supporting them. So basically what I'm saying here is he's doing this for a purpose. He's wanting his lower educated base to come out in droves for him. Therefore, he'll win in 2020 just like he can do in, well, just like he did back in 2016.
You know, this is the thing, because it does seem kind of strange that your entire strategy depends on white, undereducated men. And now, I'm not going to defend anything, because that's kind of the whole reason that Democrats are actually excited this week, because now Mr. Bob Mueller goes to D.C. for not one, but two sit-downs. And this is the thing that we got to bring up, because we're talking about Trump's base. Trump's base does not hear or read or do anything that does not come out of Donald Trump's mouth or Fox News. And Rand Paul over the weekend even tried to do that with members of NY1's television network when he kept telling them time and time again, watch Fox News, watch Fox News. It's like, I don't work for them. Well, maybe you should.
Yeah.
So, I mean, Rand Paul is just effing weird. I'm just going to say that.
Well, he's also, and I'm going to say this, and I don't mean to bring any ill upon your show or upon your product, but I'm going to say this. Rand Paul is near a piece of trash, because here's why. He had the ability to keep the fund for 9/11 first responders and bring that bill to the floor without any type of objection that was raised by New York Senator Kristen Gillibrand, and he objects to it. And now it's going to be held up longer. This is something that needs to be passed as quickly as possible. And even the president is in favor of this. And yet Rand Paul, who votes for tax cuts for the uber wealthy of this country, had the gall to say that that is a fiscally irresponsible thing to do. Screw you, Rand Paul.
Mm. Okay. Well, though we had that moment happen. But no, look, in all seriousness, yeah, that's a very terrible thing to do, specifically because the party that brought forth that bill, that birthed that bill in the first place, was the Republican.
Yeah.
Nobody remembers that.
And if John Stewart even says the Trump administration is doing a good job on this, and that should, I mean, and he's been no fan of the president, that should really speak volumes to this. I mean, so yeah, this is something that, you know, Rand Paul should feel ashamed about.
Yeah, well,
of course, I don't think he has any shame at all.
I know, but the undereducated Trump base, the white ignorant base that he has, they are going to see something like that and being like, well, yeah, we should cut them off sometime. I mean, you know, the true heroes of, and then they'll say that somebody else was the hero of 9/11 and somebody else, and then. Mm-hmm. If you dare say the veterans were the heroes of 9/11, please, by all means, talk to Tulsi Gabbard and find out how they were treated.
That's exactly right. I mean, yeah. I mean, heck, you might be able to even, you know, throw in there and say, hey, it was Captain Marvel. She was the hero.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Might as well be. But look, here's the thing. As long as we're talking about this, this week, the Democrats are looking very forward to Mueller sitting down to trial. And this is the thing that Republicans are actually afraid of. The one thing that has maintained Trump's support throughout the release of the Mueller report is the fact that his base will not read the report. They will not watch media sources that detail stuff out of the report. Nope. And if they hear any mentions of the report, it comes from something like One America News or Fox News, where it says, hey, it said that he was exonerated. That is a blatant and factual lie. It is
That's exactly right.
So this week, Dems are very excited for Mueller to come to D.C. because they're just wanting him to, on the record, read his report, because they don't think anybody's read it. Now, is that a smart strategy?
Yes. In a lot of ways, yes. In a lot of ways, no. But I think this is smart because, you know, it takes effort to read something, and the Mueller report is about 400 pages or so, divvied up into two volumes dealing with the Russian collusion and obstruction of justice. And so if you really want a very quick thing about it, you can turn to the very last page. I actually bought the Mueller report, about $13. You can go to the very last page, and it will say, this does not exonerate the president. So it's very clearly written there. I mean, you can find it there in the words. And so, yes, they want, Chairman Schiff, Adam Schiff comes out and says, I want Mueller to bring his report to life. So essentially what he's going to do, at least I wouldn't be surprised by it, is if he just brought his report, they asked him a question, he turns to a page and he goes, yes, and then he just reads right from it. I think that's a great strategy. I think that's wonderful. And I think the Republicans are going to have a tough time trying to really cross him up because Mueller, one, is a Republican, and two, has been doing this for years. So, you know, how are you going to cross him up on this? I don't know.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think it's just very interesting, though, that a while back, Mueller made a public statement saying that, basically, I have nothing to say that was not said in this report.
Yep.
I did not exonerate the president. There's 10 instances in my report that say that there was some clear obstruction happening. The Department of Justice said I can't call them crimes. So I made this report to give to you to do the rest. I have nothing more to say to you. But the thing is because nobody took the time, especially white people in America, white voters in America, none of them took the time to read the actual report. Democrats looked at that as challenge accepted.
Mm-hmm.
We will bring you in and only have you read your own words because nobody else seems to want to do so. Now, Drew, this could have precedence going forward, couldn't it?
Oh, I think so. Yes, indeed. I mean, there's a couple of things I think of here, not just the political ramifications, but just the ramifications of any report that's ever done. Now, one thing that I'm thinking about here that we didn't talk about was the aspect of, you know, if there are future reports on this about future presidents and no one wants to read it, you just bring in the guy who did the investigation and say, just read your report out loud on camera so that everyone can hear what you're saying. Because obviously we just wasted a bunch of trees and a bunch of paper and a bunch of money for you to write something that no one's going to read. So here, you read it in front of camera so everyone will now believe you.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
I'm just going to say, probably would have been better if Samuel L. Jackson would have narrated it. That's the time for what we have today. Until the next show, love you, mean it.